Welcome to Beauty and the Brain with your hosts, Dr. Chris Crowley and nurse practitioner Jerry Drinkard. Get ready to dive into the latest in revolutionary treatments, cutting-edge devices, and wellness secrets. Whether you're a consumer or provider, we're here to empower you at the forefront of beauty and aesthetics.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Beauty and the Brain, the podcast where we discuss all things aesthetics. I'm your co-host, Dr. Chris Crowley.
And I'm Jerry Drinkard, family nurse practitioner. And together, Chris and I own Skin and Tonic, a med spa located in Pace, Florida. And we're super, super excited today. We have one of our favorite people joining us on the podcast, and she's an expert in her field, but she's also a dear friend to us and colleague that we've known for several years now. And it's Dr. Betsy Greenleaf.
Hi, Betsy. Welcome.
We're so happy to have you join us.
So excited to be here, and I'm so grateful to be talking with you guys today.
Betsy is actually our first call-in guest. Betsy has been kind enough to call in. She has so many accolades behind her name and so many titles. And I agree with Jerry. We call her first and foremost a friend. I had the pleasure of meeting her first working at Empire as one of our instructors. Betsy is the director of the anti-aging division at Empire Medical. And really, it's been a pleasure teaching with her in the aesthetics and anti-aging arena for like many years now. I don't even know how many years that goes back. But more than that, she is the first board-certified urogynecologist in the U.S. She has that title. Any of you that will go on after this and follow her social media, you'll see that that is the most entertaining. I think Jerry loves it more than anyone. He is your number one fan, Betsy. I hear all the time, did you see what she put today?
It's inspiring, and it's one of those things that it's really nice to see somebody breathe like a little bit of light life into some topics that can be really heavy. So I think like Betsy's personality does a really good job at doing that and kind of putting us all at ease with something that we're not always comfortable with. So I'm anxious to see what all we have to talk
about. Yeah, who knows where you guys will take this conversation. I just have to brace myself. I'm along for the ride. I'm like, you know, who knows where Jerry and Betsy are going to go with this. But Dr. Greenleaf, as a board-certified urogynecologist, is clearly an expert in all things related to sexual health, pelvic health. And we're going to really dive into some topics today that can be a little bit difficult to discuss for some people. And as Jerry said, you do a really great job of breaking down those barriers, empowering the women that you treat, as well as some of the men and their partners in their life. We have these discussions all the time. I want to take a little bit of time just to for our audience to get to know you a little bit better. And then we're going to dive into some of those topics and talk about some pelvic health and how this maybe affects our life overall and things that we may not even think about, like our gut and our gut microbiome, how that can affect all the other parts of our health in our body. So again, thanks for being here with us. Maybe do you want to take a few minutes to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So yeah, you're right. I have a lot of letters after my name, and actually I just added some more. So I'm the first female board certified urogynecologist in the United States. I'm double board certified in obstetrics and gynecology and urogynecology and triple board certified in aesthetics. I just recently got my MBA in 2020. And as of last weekend, I now just got another business degree in strategic management, innovation, and entrepreneurship. So basically, I absolutely love learning. And the pelvic health and women's health are probably my favorite topics. I love speaking. And you guys are funny, you know, with the social media. I like performing. So whenever I can come up with some funny skits to do on social media, I do them. I think I crack myself up more than anybody else because I look at them and I'm going, all right, well, not as many people are looking at these things as I thought. But I'm like, all right, if I just make myself laugh, that's good enough.
So how did you, first from urogynecology, I mean, that's a, you know, very subspecialized. And again, as a first female in that field, that had to be tough to go through some of the training that you had to go through to really achieve that. And then to venture from that more to this holistic approach, right? That's probably a little bit controversial. And I'm sure you, as well as, you know, I did, coming from an academic medical center, took a little bit of pressure from my colleagues and peers when I started talking about some more holistic treatments and looking at things a little bit differently than the traditional medicine approach that we were taught in medical school. Have you found that challenging?
Oh, definitely. And actually, back it up even further, I started off in general surgery and got halfway through general surgery and was like, yeah, this isn't for me, because I was the person going around wanting to really like connect with my patients. And I love general surgeons. They're great. You need them if your appendix is bursting. But I was the person who was going around going, so feel now that your appendix is out. Like, how do you feel now that your gallbladder is out? And like, general surgery is not this warm, fuzzy type of a profession. It's more like a body mechanic, which we need them, and that's good. So that's why I switched to OBGYN. But even then, I like sleeping, and babies come at all times of the night. And I didn't even know urogynecology was a specialty until my last rotation, my senior year in residency. And all of a sudden, I was like, oh, this is what I want to do. And I remember coming home and telling my mom I was going to go off and do a fellowship in urogynecology. And she was like, what is that? She's like, is it like fancy gynecology, like European, like Euro Disney? And I was like, no, it's urology and gynecology. So it's like bladder health and pelvic health and everything combined. And then I trained right during the height of the vaginal mesh, which is now a big controversy. And many people have probably seen the 1-800 bad drug commercials. But, you know, we all trained on mesh as a way to fix the pelvic floor. And as I was going through my career and starting to see more problems with that product, I started to really question my traditional medical training. And I'm like, why are we doing things that are potentially causing harm? And then even looking at the medications we were throwing at people, I'm like, this isn't fixing the problem. It's just masking things. So it kind of set me on this journey of, well, like, let's figure out how we can actually heal people and get them to live their, you know, true, authentic, healthy lives. And once I went down that rabbit hole, it kind of hasn't ever stopped. I just keep finding more and more information, and it's really been pretty fascinating. But unfortunately, that integrative functional type of approach, even though it's becoming more popular, has been a little bit on the fringe of traditional medicine.
I mean, and I agree with you. We definitely, you know, see that you're for sure more of an expert in the functional medicine side of things than I am. But even as I just scratch the surface a little bit and look into it, I realize that there is such a lack of education in our traditional medical education to even begin to understand this, much less actually help guide our patients through some of these journeys. So with pelvic health specifically, I know it's a broad question, but what are some of the common, you know, misconceptions that you see that when you're getting these patients into your practice compared to your colleagues that are doing traditional urogynecology or just gynecologic practices?
I think, you know, the biggest thing is patients in general just assume that if something's happening down there, that it's a normal part of aging, and then that's just the way it is, and they kind of give up, especially with things like incontinence. So people are leaking urine. I mean, that it's incredibly common. People don't talk about it. And the pad and diaper industry is a bazillion-dollar industry. I don't know the exact numbers, but, you know, it's a couple billion-dollar industry a year. And so people just get to the point where they think like, oh, this is just part of getting older. Same thing with sexual dysfunction. They think, all right, well, you know, I've had a good life and things worked, and now they don't. And that's just the way it is. And people pretty much accept it. And they don't even really think about asking about, you know, is there something more that can be done? And is there any help? I think the biggest thing, you know, when it came to the aesthetic world is vaginal rejuvenation. I mean, for years, there was only two products on the market when I did my training. It was estrace cream and Premarin cream, which are both estrogen creams. And that was really what the only thing that was on the market for years and years and years. And then in 2014, in the United States, all of a sudden the vaginal laser came out. And that's something I wish I had thought of, because I'm like, oh my God, that's brilliant. Because lasers have been around for skin rejuvenation since the 1980s. And so somebody was like, well, if we can rejuvenate skin on our face, why can't we rejuvenate, you know, the vagina and the vulva with light energy? And so they basically took a facial laser, made a different probe, and voila, now we have, you know, vaginal rejuvenation. And that pretty much opened a whole field of where companies started going, wait a minute, we know aesthetics. We have all this stuff available for aesthetics. Why don't we just retool it, reformulate it, and make it for pelvic health and see if it works? And now it's like a booming industry. We have so many more options when it comes to vaginal rejuvenation.
But even that's still controversial within the gynecology world, correct?
Yeah, it is, unfortunately. And I don't know why. I think, you know, when it comes to anything that's new, and we see this just in business, there's this business model where there's always going to be the first people that are going to, you know, the first adopters that are going to really try a new technology and see how it works. And then it takes years and years and years before the majority of the people in this curve, this business curve, decide to be like, well, this is something we're willing to try. I think the other problem is there's no research money in this. So if there was research money, then they'd be able to do more research on these products and treatments, and then would help some of those more traditional doctors are a little bit more conservative and waiting for like everybody to do it. It would get them more on board if we had more research, but you can't get the research unless you have the money to pay for research. So it's an unfortunate thing.
This may be like a little bit of a landmine question, and I don't know what we'll uncover with this, but do you think that this is different than so when we talk about pelvic health and obviously sexual function, there's a lot of people who feel like because that's just something pleasurable that if it goes away, that it's okay. Especially, I think women have a lot of trouble talking about that. But it seems like there's been a lot of research money and drug development poured into male sexual dysfunction, right? We have a lot of options for guys and a lot of treatments for guys. But it doesn't seem like for females that it's as talked about as much. So do you think that there is a gender difference and there's a thought that females should just accept that things aren't working as part of the aging compared to males, that it should work until the day they go to the grave?
Yeah, there's so many things to unpack with that question. Definitely, there's a bias in research. There's more money going into this for men. There's also this, there's definitely amongst the general population, there's this thought amongst women like, oh, well, like, this is just the way it is. And women accept it and they don't question it. And then I think the other problem is that female sexuality is a little bit more complicated than male sexuality. So when we think about, I don't know, I'm taking you back to your biology class. I don't know if you guys remember learning that Masters and Johnson's curve on arousal, where it was like desire, arousal, and then there's this plateau, and then there's orgasm, and then there's resolution. And it's a very linear model. Well, they found, and that's great, like Masters and Johnson did an amazing job, and they were the, you know, what that them and Kinsey were some of the first people to bring sexual research to the forefront, but it's a little antiquated when it comes to the female sexual response. And there's another researcher, Rosemary Basson, who's remodeled the female sexual response, which is absolutely fascinating. And if you ever get a chance to look it up, if you guys just Google like Rosemary Basson, Basson, and female sexual response, it's a bunch of interlocking circles. Rosemary says, even though spontaneous arousal can still happen and kind of follow that curve that we see with Masters and Johnson, more often, especially as women age, spontaneous arousal is less likely to happen. Not that it can't, but it's less likely. And I think that's the other thing that in general, people kind of sit around, they think it's like the movies, like all of a sudden you're supposed to be like walking hand in hand on the beach. And then next thing you know, you're like rolling in the sand. And for most women, it's not that instantaneous. So in Rosemary Basson's model, it's you have to have willingness to engage in sexual activity even before the desire and arousal. So just going through the motions and being willing and open with a partner or with yourself will then even lead into some physiologic changes that stimulate arousal. And then the arousal happens before the desire. And then the person goes, oh, you know what? This is something I think I might want to do. And then it takes off. A lot of women, and especially the ones I talk to, always come in, they complain like my sex drive isn't the way it used to be. And there's so many different factors with that, with female sexual response. It also has to do with dopamine. The longer we're with a partner, it's actually harder to get that dopamine spike, that excitement spike, unfortunately. And then the one way to do that is just with novelty, to try to bring new things into the situation. So there's so many. And then even I go off on the products like Viagra or Cialis, and they're blood flow pills. And yes, men need blood flow to the penis to get an erection, but nobody's created a horny pill yet. So, and I don't think they're going to, because there's so, I always say the brain is your most important sex organ, and everybody's brain is different when it comes to what stimulates them. So creating a pill that's going to stimulate us and put us in the mood is going to be pretty far off. I mean, we know some of the hormones and chemicals that'll do it, but you don't even know if it's going to work that way. So I even told the company that makes Viagra, when they were doing research on women, they were looking at libido. And I'm like, well, Viagra's not, it's a blood flow pill. All it does in men, it causes blood to rush to the penis and they get an erection if their brain is mentally stimulated. If you take a Viagra and your brain is not mentally stimulated, nothing's going to happen. And in women, Viagra actually can work in women. They take it, and if they're mentally stimulated, it will increase blood flow to the pelvis. And in women, you get actually engorgement of the clitoris, so it helps with clitoral sensitivity and helps with lubrication. So they studied it for libido, not these other effects. And I'm like, you guys are studying the wrong thing. I'm like, it's not going to help with libido. It doesn't put you in the mood. I'm like, it's going to help with functioning of the pelvic floor. Actually, those medications can be used in both men and women.
Part of that is when we talk about desire and arousal, it's usually prompted by something that's pleasurable. And so if you have if sex is not pleasurable with these women and there's nothing to be aroused about, oftentimes it even seems like a job. And we hear this in the clinic, because this is our patient population. This is, you know, like, we have a lot of perimenopausal, postmenopausal women, even young women that have had hysterectomies early on, you know, your polycystic patient. If sex isn't pleasurable for whatever reason, and they may think that until they openly talk about it, because you don't get this with a lot of the family practitioners. I mean, on your, you know, just routine health visits, people don't talk about it. And so, you know, when they come in and they find out that there are things that can be done to help with painful intercourse and to help with, you know, chronic vaginal dryness, or to help with, you know, stress incontinence that can become an issue during, like, sexual intercourse, all of those things really, that impacts libido, because if it's a job or if it's something that's embarrassing, you're not going to be excited about it.
Yeah, exactly. And then unfortunately, because of hormonal changes, you get actually changes in the tissue of the vagina and the vulva. And we always attribute it to perimenopausal, menopausal women, but it can happen in anyone whose estrogen levels are low. And that tends to be pregnant women, breastfeeding women, women on birth control actually will get lower estrogen. And so anytime we lower the estrogen, especially in menopause, we start losing like 30% of our collagen a year after menopause, and our tissue becomes elastin. We start losing that stretchability to that tissue. And I have people think of a rubber band. Like, a new rubber band is nice and stretchy. You stretch it, it stretches back, it looks fine. But an old rubber band that is, maybe that rubber has gotten a little dry, when you stretch it, it cracks, it rips, it might even break. So that's what ends up happening to the vaginal tissue when it loses that nice elasticity. Now, when they're having sex, women will often complain if it feels like cut glass, or it hurts, or it burns, or they feel like they're getting cut. And they actually are, because that tissue is not stretching and like kind of coming back the way it should be. And the tissue tends to be very dry. And I think the worst thing is when I found out about the science of lubricants. I mean, a lot of times the answer for women is, well, just use a lubricant, which that is a great option as long as you're picking the right lubricant. And for many years, I'm going to throw KY under the, I hate like sometimes naming brands and throwing them under the bus, but I'm going to throw KY jelly under the bus, because that's a big go-to. They've built their name over the years for lubrication, but KY jelly is specifically made with a pH that's not balanced for the vagina. And the osmolality, which is the solute concentration of this solution, is also not balanced. It's almost like pouring salt on a slug so that it purposely dries out the tissue. And so people have to use more and more of the product. And I think, you know, it was women like Wendy Strugar, who started the company Good Clean Love. She herself was having problems with lubricants and was getting recurrent infections and was still having dryness, that she was like, wait a minute, something's not right. And she was one of the first people to look into what is the pH and the osmolarity of these products, and developed her own that was safe and balanced for the vagina. And then we have some other companies that are now following suit with that. Like, I think my other favorite ones are like Uberlube. But I mean, you guys know, working in the hospital, I mean, Surgilube is something that is in like every doctor's office and in the hospital. And that too is not healthy for vaginal tissue. But yet, you know, the top ones that are being used medically or you know, and people think of, is definitely the KY jelly, which I say stay away from.
Clearly, there's so much we could talk about and go on for hours with this conversation, but I want to switch gears a little bit to talk about something you're passionate about and something that you've done a lot of work on. You've done some TED-like talks with these brain-gut-vagina connections, and I know you're big on gut health. We even tried to get Jerry to do some things with you. He has not been compliant and done this yet. One day we're going to get...
One day we're going to get my vagina healthy.
Yeah, one day we're going to get his vagina. So what made you originally get interested in gut health and how it connects, right? I mean, it seems like a bit of a stretch. Like, people wouldn't think that gut health has anything to do with your pelvic floor or with your brain. I think that a lot of patients are like, what does my stomach have to do or my gut have to do with my brain?
It was kind of serendipity. It kind of happened where I was trying to figure out problems for my patients and traditional medical options were not working. And then I too was having my own problems. So basically I was seeing a lot of patients that were getting recurrent urinary tract infections, recurrent vaginal infections. Even what they teach in medical school now for vaginal infections is what they used to teach in the 1950s. It was basically like, do a swab of the vagina, look at it under the microscope. You used to put this solution called potassium hydroxide on it. And if it smelled like fish, then that was a bacterial infection. It's like, and it's not very accurate. So probably about 20 years ago now, I found a company that did more of like a microbiome test of the vagina. And I was like, ooh, let's look into that. Like, the more information, the better. So I started doing that test and started finding things. And then it was, especially when it came to yeast, I would treat patients for vaginal yeast and they'd be good. And then it would come back. And I'm like, why is this coming? Like, I got to figure out this problem. And I don't even know how I finally figured it out. But I think it was kind of around the time where there was a lot of information coming out about gut health. And I'm like, oh, as a urogynecologist, we're always talking about women about wiping from front to back because you don't want the bacteria from the rectum, because the rectum, the vagina, and the urethra are so close together. We don't want the bacteria going back and forth. And then I started thinking, like, wait a minute, like, if bacteria is going back and forth and I get people who are getting recurrent vaginal infections and they're getting recurrent urinary tract infections because the vagina and the urethra are very close together, and it's not necessarily always a wiping issue, like, maybe these bacteria are just kind of, because all these organs are so close together, maybe they're kind of getting back and forth somehow. And I'm like, well, wait a minute, what's going on in the rectum? Like, maybe we should know, be looking at the bacteria and stuff that's in the rectum. And it was one of my yeast patients that actually asked me to test her gut for yeast. And it was kind of like around the same time I was thinking that myself, and we did, and her gut was filled with yeast. So we're like, okay, great, let's treat your gut for yeast. And we did, and then her vaginal infections went away. And it was like, huh. And then I, too, myself, from the time I was like a teenager, was constantly getting yeast infections. And at the same time, I'd always break out in a, like, something on my scalp. And I was being told by the dermatologist that it was psoriasis. And I'm like, well, why every time I get psoriasis on my scalp, do I also get a yeast infection? And I was also connecting it to things I was eating. Like, it seemed like every time I was eating a diet that was high in carbohydrates or high in sugars, this was happening. And then even more so, around the same time, there was a lot of talk in the integrative and functional world about this gut-brain connection and how, so 95% of your happy hormone, serotonin, is made in your gut. And 80% of your immune system, secretory IgA, is also made in the gut. So like all these things were starting to connect. And around the same time, I personally had a hysterectomy. And after my hysterectomy, I was having so many issues with my mood. Like, I know that some people might have called, you know, might classify it as depression or anxiety, but I just felt really bitchy all the time. I was like angry and then sad and then angry, and I was really bitchy. And at the same time, I was also getting sick all the time. I was getting, end up having my tonsils out as an adult, and I was getting sick. And then one day I go, wait a minute, what does depression, anxiety, immune system things have in common? And I was like, my gut. So then I finally tested my own gut and found myself that my gut was filled with yeast. And I'm like, wait a minute, that connects to the pelvic health stuff. And I had also, from the time I had been married, had my own problems with recurrent bladder infections. And so I also had an overabundance of certain bacteria in my gut that are associated with recurrent urinary tract infections. And I'm like, wait a minute, all this stuff is connecting. So I did a protocol for myself to clear up my gut. And that was probably like 3 or 4 years ago. And I can't even tell you the last time I had a vaginal infection after that. But not only that, but my mood got better. And I stopped getting sick all the time, even to the point where I was seeing an immunologist at one point where she said I had this primary immune deficiency, which is this hereditary problem. And so after I like healed my gut, I went to her and she did the test and she's like, I got good news and bad news. She's like, the good news is your tests are all normal. She's like, the bad news is I don't know why. And I was like, I know why, because I healed my gut. And then I started to say, well, there's something more to this. And actually going into PubMed, which is a database of medical research, I started finding more research on this. And I would say over the last 5 years, there's been more and more research. And what was really interesting was when the research was starting to connect sex drives and the gut. And I'm like, what? And even then there was research connecting the vaginal microbiome and the gut. And so this theory is, if the bacteria or yeast in the gut is imbalanced for men or women, because I've done the studies in both, that's going to cause inflammation. And when there's inflammation in the body, that's a stressor. And anytime the body is under stress, it's going to suppress certain pathways, especially sex, because the body doesn't know the difference between you're trying to reproduce versus you're trying to have a good time. So it just knows, hey, you're inflamed. This is not an ideal to reproduce. So we're going to squash everything that has to do with reproduction. And that means sex drive, hormones can affect women. It can affect their periods. And men, it can affect sex drive. It's going to just suppress everything until that inflammation is gone. And so we definitely found that they think the signal is through the vagus nerve to the brain. We know that the gut can do this, but also they know for women, the vaginal microbiome can do the same thing. So if the vaginal microbiome is off, they think there's this feedback loop through the vagus nerve to the brain to be like, okay, it's not the ideal time to reproduce. So let's squash all those problems. So here's actually another funny story, which my friend did not find very funny at the time. But I had a friend who is a nurse who worked for me for years. She had been in a long 6-year relationship with this guy. They weren't purposely trying to have a baby, but they were not trying not to. And over 6 years, she never got pregnant. So she just assumed she couldn't get pregnant. And she was seeing what I was doing in the office for my patients and testing their vaginal microbiome. And she was like, hey, you know what? Can you test my microbiome? And we tested her vaginal microbiome. It was all, you know, kind of wonky. And we did some things to rebalance the vaginal microbiome. And needless to say, during this time, she broke up with the boyfriend that she'd been with for 6 years, met a friend of mine. They started dating. And like in the first week of their sexual activity, she got pregnant. And it, going back, it was not, you know, some people would be like, oh, maybe it was the old boyfriend. It was his problem. No, because they had gone for testing and the old boyfriend was testing fine. So she jokes to this day that like, I have to pay, that it's my fault that she.
you got to pay child support.
And then I got to be paying child support or my support. I'm like, listen, you know how these things happen. So so it's been really fascinating to really think about how the microbiome affects our bodies. And I was one of those moms, like I was a germaphobe. Like when I had my kids, I'd be running behind them with the hand sanitizer. And that's probably one of the worst things that I could have done. Like we're supposed to be interacting with bacteria and germs and yeast, you know, to a certain point to build up our immune systems. So if we look at how we evolved as humans, we didn't evolve to have refrigeration. Now I know having refrigerators is good food safety, but the point is, we were eating more bacteria in our foods. And so the way I tell people to get that in their diets is just eat more fermented foods. We should be eating fermented foods every single day, whether that's sauerkraut or kimchi or yogurt, beer, kombucha, like something to replenish the body of that bacteria, because we need it in our gut. And if our gut is healthy, then our vagina is healthy. And if you're a man, if your gut's healthy, your sex drive is healthy and your fertility is healthy. And if you're a woman, your sex drive and libido and vagina is healthy and your bladder's healthy. So it all, you know, it all goes together.
Well, again, I think it clearly just from this short conversation, people can see that you're a wealth of knowledge. I could talk to you all day about this kind of stuff. But one of the things that we often talk about, and for any of your patients, our patients, or people who wanted to see any of us in the practice, I think that first step is just having an open conversation, and hopefully people can tell from this podcast and from hearing us talk and you talk that we're very open to these kind of conversations. And I think, you know, sometimes people are hesitant to bring up these topics, but I'm sure you see it. The minute we open that door and give just one little signal that we're okay, we're very open to hear all sorts of discussions and help them with these problems, they will open up and share this with us. So thank you for coming on and sharing some of these insights. Before we close up here, I want to talk a little bit about some of your entrepreneurial adventures. We both are big entrepreneurs. You just got a degree in it, so you're definitely well ahead of me in this arena. But it's a lot of fun, and I know one of the, you know, your ventures is looking at just a vagina spa, if you will, right? And so I know you've toyed with some different names there. Have you ever come up with a plan yet, or an actual name, or what you're doing with that?
No, in fact, I did come up with a name, but the new plans, and you guys are getting a sneak peek to this one, is actually more to, because I found that people are still resistant to the idea of, like, even though there's like vaginal steaming places out there, still people are kind of shy and like are a little bit resistant to like walking into a place like this. And in polling my audience, I found that they really think hormones are more the issue, and menopause and andropause. So now actually we're looking at opening a potentially the International Pause Institute, which will be taking care of perimenopause, menopause, and andropause.
Oh,
so
very
all
nice.
those, and then incorporate all this other stuff, including a vagina spa under that same umbrella.
Under the same umbrella, yeah. Okay, good deal.
You can make a beautiful entranceway to the building, like kind of an arch shape, like a vagina. Like,
or here he goes. Here you and Jerry go.
I don't know if that'll scare away my men or if it would.
Or welcome them.
I was gonna say it.
Yeah, it may scare away your gay men.
We've talked more about vaginas in the past 45 minutes than we have in years.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Betsy. I really appreciate it. Like, seriously, it's been great talking to you. We'll have to have you on again where we can dive more into this stuff. Like, we've already like went over our time, and it seems like we've been talking 2 minutes.
I know. This is something I could talk about hours. It's so easy. And talking to you guys is so much fun anyway.
Everyone, thanks for tuning in today to another episode of Beauty and the Brain. Again, thank you to Dr. Betsy Greenleaf, one of our dear friends and obviously clearly an expert in her field. We're going to put links to all of her social media, her website. She has a great website, The Pelvic Floor Store, where you can go and check out some supplements and tools that she shares and that she offers for retail that you can perhaps purchase to optimize your pelvic floor health. We look forward to seeing you guys again next week on another episode of Beauty and the Brain.
See you soon.